The book of Joel. The book of locusts. Locusts can grow up to 3 inches long. There was an article that appeared in 2013, Eating Locusts, the Crunchy Kosher Snack, Taking Israel by Swarm. Israel is in the grip of a locust invasion, it said. Farmers are seeing their crops gobbled up in minutes, and some people are taking a novel approach to pest control, eating them. Rabbi Ari Zivotofsky's children have been busy in the kitchen. On the menu, breaded locusts and chocolate-covered locusts. Israel is dealing with a locust emergency. For the last 2 weeks, the skies in the south have been swathed in a swarming carpet of insects. 2013. Most biblical references about locusts are not about diet, they are about judgment. All the way from the plague in Egypt up to the book of Joel, that's our concern this morning, locusts appear from time to time. A desert locust swarm can cover up over 400 square miles. You know how big that is? 20 miles by 20 miles, right? And if it's a circle, it's maybe 30 miles in diameter. A desert locust swarm can cover that area, and they can pack between 40 and 80 million locusts into less than half a square mile. Each locust can eat its weight in plant material every day. They're a devastating creature. In chapter 1, verse 1, we read, "The word of the Lord came to Joel, son of Pethuel." That's what we know about Joel. Of the 13 Joels mentioned in the Old Testament, he is identified with no other. There are 12 others, and he stands alone at the head of his book. He calls on everyone. He calls on the lame. He calls on the old and the young and the drunkards and the farmers and the priests. But he has no catalog of the sins of the nation. He doesn't mention their sins. There's no, unlike the other prophets, Joel does not list the sins of the people to whom he is preaching. Now, the approach that I would like to take is this, and you're free to disagree with me, but and part of it is very ambiguous. That is, the text is very difficult to understand, especially when you read different versions. But here's the approach I'd like to take. I think roughly chapter 1 has to do with a literal locust plague. Chapter 2, I think, has to do with an invading army. And chapter 3 has to do with final judgment. Now, let me try and explain why you may disagree with that. First of all, most of the prophets, if you just sort of leaf through that part of your Bible, what do you see? That most of the prophets wrote in poetry. They wrote in poetic lines. When I began to study English literature, I discovered that up to a certain point, somewhere in the Middle Ages, that's all they wrote, poetry. And then after that point, they began to get the clue that you could write prose. But before that, it was all poetry. And so the prophets apparently took that tack, and they wrote in poetic lines. Therefore, I say, you ought to expect poetic language. Therefore, you ought to expect metaphors and pictures, images, rather than literal statements. They are like a verbal picture book where the prophets portray for us images for our imagination. They can therefore be interpreted quite differently. If you take any little pile of commentaries, that's obvious. They can be interpreted quite differently. And people much wiser than I am have done so. Let me illustrate what I mean by poetic language. I have sometimes given a class writing assignment where I would have them write in class a paragraph, and the paragraph is to begin with this sentence. The best kind of exercise is to bend down and lift somebody up. Can you write a paragraph on that? Now, there are two ways of interpreting that. One is to interpret it literally, and the other is to interpret it metaphorically. I have had a few students who have interpreted it literally. I had a guy, for example, who would write this: be careful when you lift somebody up to bend at the knees, or you will hurt your back. You see, he took it quite literally. I was a little bit stunned when I read that, because that was not my intention at all. He didn't take it metaphorically. He didn't take it poetically. Or here's a passage from Joel. Before them, the earth shakes, and the heavens tremble. The sun and the moon are darkness, and the skies no longer shine. Is that literal or poetic? Or this: come, trample the grapes, for the winepress is full, and the vats overflow, so great is their wickedness. What winepress? What vats? No, it's a metaphor. The language is the language of poetry. And therefore, I believe we need to interpret these prophets as poetry. What I'm saying is we don't need to take every word literally. We need to understand their meaning, and their meaning is conveyed through poetry. And we need to understand it as poetic language. Now, if you add to that, that they are prophetically telling the future, it seems to me that that adds another dimension. Prophecy is typically difficult to understand and interpret, and I believe that that's intentional. Otherwise, we would know what's going to happen tomorrow and the next day, or at least the days the Lord told us about. But we are kind of indefinite about all that. Take, for example, these words, again from Joel. And afterwards, I will pour out my spirit on all people. Your sons and daughters will prophesy. Your old men will dream dreams. Your young men will see visions. Even on my servants, both men and women, I will pour out my spirit in those days. I will show wonders in the heavens and on the earth, blood and fire and billows of smoke. Well, we saw part of that fulfilled on the day of Pentecost, but we didn't see wonders in the heavens and blood and fire and smoke. We didn't see any of that on the day of Pentecost. We saw part of it fulfilled. There's a kind of melding together of two things. We believe the other will happen, but so far only part of that has happened. It's poetic language. We Westerners like a very ordered outline. Some people actually sit in church and copy down the preacher's outline. You see, that we're Westerners. That's how we think. Most of the world doesn't think like that. They have a different approach. And what the prophets are presenting to us is like images. It's kind of like a movie, and sometimes it goes like this. You know how in a movie they will sometimes fade from one image to another? They'll fade from one scene to one totally different scene from one scene to a totally different scene. And part of the and then you see the fade. And I think that's what the prophets are doing. When Joel prophesies, your young men and women will see visions and whatnot, and then there will be signs in the heavens. I think he's fading from one scene to another, scenes that are very much separate historically, but he just puts them together. And then you add to those two things, to the fact that we're dealing with poetry and the fact that we're dealing with prophecy, you add to that the fact that we're dealing with 6 or 7 or 8 or 10 or 60 different translations, and they all give a different impression. So in other words, what I'm saying is prophecy is difficult to interpret. The prophets are difficult to interpret. So the word of the Lord came to Jonah, and we look at chapter 1, and here's what we see: a swarm of locusts and a call to mourning. And as I said, Joel, unlike the other prophets, does not give us a catalog of Israel's sins. I think, now, so here's where we can differ. I think what he does is describe a plague of locusts that has already happened in army language. They come with these teeth and all that stuff. He describes it in army language, and then he goes to chapter 2 and describes an army coming in locust language. See, he seems to use army language and locust language in both cases, and it's difficult, therefore, to sort out which is which. So, let's look at some of the things he says. In chapter 1, verses 6 and 7, we read this. A nation has invaded my land, a mighty army, without number. It has the teeth of a lion and the fangs of a lioness. It has laid waste my vines and ruined my fig trees. It has stripped off their bark and thrown it away, leaving their branches white. Now, what would you say if that happened here? What if we had a plague of locusts and it just stripped the landscape? One of the comments that Pam's brother once made when he was visiting was, he's coming from Colorado, and he says, there's so many trees here. Everything's trees. Everything's covered with trees. It's not like that in the West. Everything here is covered with trees. And what if a locust came and just stripped all of that? And it looked like the dead of winter in the middle of summer. How would you interpret that? Along comes Joel and says, judgment of God. You need to repent. You need to come back to God. You need to return to the Lord. And so he gives them a call to repentance that goes like this. Put on sackcloth, you priests, and mourn, who minister before my God, for the grain offerings and drink offerings are withheld from the house of your God. Declare a holy fast, call a sacred assembly. Their sin has affected their worship. He calls on the priests to declare a holy fast because he says the people's sins have affected their worship. The people's sins have taken them away from the Lord. They have affected their worship. And then we go to chapter 2 and we read this. We read about what I'm calling the invading army, and of course you're free to differ with me on that, on whether it is indeed an army. I'm suggesting that that God is using this language which goes between locusts and army and all that stuff, and he's foretelling that there may be a coming army, and it may be the Babylonians coming in to defeat Judah and to carry them into captivity. That's sort of the way I see it, but of course, not everyone does. But I'm not sure, as long as we get the message, I'm not sure that matters. All right, chapter 2, verses 1 and 2. Blow the trumpet in Zion, sound the alarm on my holy hill. Let all who live in the land tremble, for the day of the Lord is coming. The day of the Lord is coming. This is something future. This is something that is coming. It is close at hand. I'll read on in the next verse. A day of darkness and gloom, a day of clouds and blackness, like dawn spreading across the mountains, a large and mighty army comes, such as never was in ancient times, nor ever will be in ages to come. The locust plague has already come in chapter 1, and he says, look, there's a day of darkness coming. It's not over. There's something else coming. And I take it to be an invading army, perhaps of the Babylonians. He said it's close at hand, and it's identified with what he calls the day of the Lord. And I'm going to pause in a moment and talk about the day of the Lord. There are many features of the army that are described are kind of locust features. And of course, we saw that many of the locust description was taken up with army features. But it is a day that will come. It's another intervention of God in judgment. Now, let me talk about the day of the Lord, if I may. Go back to this. We have the locust plague in chapter 1. We have the invading army in chapter 2. And then the final judgment in chapter 3. And here's what I think is meant by the day of the Lord. I think that when that phrase is used, it means that, generally speaking, we are going through history. There will be the day of the Jews. There will be the day of the Romans, the Greeks. There'll be the day of the Romans. There'll be, you know, each facet of humanity will have its day, and then God will intervene, and there'll be the Lord. The Lord will intervene. The Lord will come in judgment. And He came in the locust plague. He's going to come in this army that's coming, and he's going to come in the final day and final judgment. I think that's what is meant by the day of the Lord. It's the day when humanity will have to reckon with God. It's the day when humanity will face the judgment it has earned. It's the day when humanity will have to face the fact that God is God and we. That's what he means by the day of the Lord. Now, typically we use that phrase, the day of the Lord, to mean the third of these. That is the final judgment, when God comes in final judgment on mankind. Typically that's how we use it. But it seems to me that it's also used in other cases in intermediate places where God comes in judgment and intervenes. It's the intervention of God in human history. It's the coming of God into human history in judgment so as to punish people or to call them back to himself. All right. He does say it's close at hand, and that leads me to believe that it's something other than the final coming of the day of the Lord. In Malachi, if you look at the last page of the Old Testament, the day of the Lord is clearly that coming of the Lord in final judgment, when he's going to judge the nations. Clearly, that's the big pick. That's the big issue of the day of the Lord. But it seems to me that there are these other intermediate judgments when God comes to judge the nations. All right. Now I want to continue a little bit in chapter 2, and I want to pause in the middle of chapter 2 and read this passage. Chapter 2, verses 13 and 14. Rend your hearts and not your garments. Return to the Lord your God, for he is gracious and compassionate, slow to anger and abounding in love, and he relents. Underline that word. He relents from sending calamity. Who knows? He may turn and relent and leave behind a blessing. Maybe God will withhold his judgment and turn and leave behind a blessing. God calls in verse 17, he calls the priests to intercede. He says, let the priests who minister before the Lord weep before the portico and the altar. Why should they say among the peoples, where is your God? Now, if you're following the text, that's verse 17. I think something happens between 17 and 18. He's calling the priests to intercede for the nation in verse 17, and then I think that intercession happens. I think the priests actually pray between 17 and 18, because he says in verse 18, then the Lord was jealous for his land and took pity on his people. That sounds like an answer to the prayer that God had invited in verse 17. So it seems to me that the priests, in fact, took up the challenge and prayed for the people, and God is answering their prayer in verse 18. I want to make 2 points from this. First of all, God planned on judging the people. That was his plan. He's going to judge them. He sent the locust. He's going to send an army. He's going to send this judgment, right? He planned on judging the people. He didn't want to. He didn't like it. He didn't like that he had to judge them. He wanted them to cling to him and follow him, but they left him, and he had to judge them. He didn't want to judge them. He called the priests to pray. And my question is, what does that mean? Why does he call the priests to pray? Why didn't he just stop the judgment himself? Why didn't he stop the judgment himself? Well, let me give you a suggestion. This is a verse that's been very, very helpful to me, and I hope it is to you. This is a verse that I think is helpful to me in the area of prayer, and it's in Psalm 115, and it goes like this. The heavens belong to the Lord, but the earth he has given to mankind. I think that's a significant statement, that the heavens belong to the Lord. Look, I know that God is sovereign and God is over all and God is in control and all that stuff, but think about the details. God made us, God made mankind, he put us on earth and he gave us responsibility to subdue the earth, right? And he made us in his own image, he made us as persons. We're not puppets, we're persons. And he gave us the responsibility for the earth. God is in his heavens, but the earth he has given to mankind. And I don't think God rides roughshod over us. I don't think God violates our will. I don't think God violates our conscience. I don't think God violates any of that. God gave us the responsibility for the earth, and we are responsible for it. The heavens belong to the Lord, the earth he has given to mankind. How do we get God? How does God then intervene in the history of mankind? By prayer. That when someone prays, they give God a channel through which he can give his blessing to us. They give God a channel so that he can act in the course of history. Because he has given us the earth, he has given us responsibility for the earth, and he doesn't constantly manipulate us. God's not a manipulator. God is not a puppeteer. But God will come in and help us if we ask him. I think that's something that's been very helpful to me, and I hope I'm not stretching it beyond its limits. Now, if that is so, if God planned to judge them and God called the priests to intervene, then we have this. that God changed his mind. Right? Return to the Lord your God. Excuse me. Let me read you verse chapter 2, verse 13. Return to the Lord your God, for he is gracious and compassionate, slow to anger, and abounding in love, and he relents from sending calamity. God changed his mind. But then you ask, well, doesn't the Bible teach that God doesn't change? Sure. The Bible teaches that God does not change. I, the Lord, do not change, right? But this says God will relent. Is that not? Let me give you an analogy. I have a friend whom I have known for years and who is solid. I mean, he is absolutely 110% dependable. I would trust him with my life. I would trust him with my wife. I would trust him with my family. He is absolutely dependable. I've known him for years and he has never changed. He's always like that. Always. Question. Has he ever changed his mind on anything? Of course. Of course he's changed his mind. So what I said when I said he'd never changed, I meant he's never changed his character. He can change his mind, but he can't change his character. He hasn't changed his character. His character is solid. His character is dependable. His character is trustworthy. God's character is solid. God's character is dependable. God's character is trustworthy. My friend has changed his mind, and God can change his mind. I mean, how can God be a person, a personal God, if he can't change his mind? How can God be going to do something and you pray and ask him to do not to do it? Can he change his mind and not do it? How can you pray and ask God to do something and then can't he change his mind and do it? I mean, just as we are not puppets, neither is God locked into some box where he cannot change his mind. That's not heresy, right? I'm not preaching. Is that okay, theologians? See, I mean, I can't even imagine what it would be like to have a God who was all categories and pigeonholes and never changed his, and wasn't actually a thinking person. When God made us in his image, that's part of it. All right. So, we come to chapter 3. In chapter 3, we have what I'm calling the judgment of the nations and the blessings of God's people. And in chapter 3, verse 1 and 2, we read these words. In those days and at that time, when I restore the fortunes of Judah and Jerusalem, I will gather all nations and bring them down to the valley of Jehoshaphat. There I will put them on trial for what they did to my inheritance, my people Israel, because they scattered my people among the nations and divided up my land. Ah, we've moved. We've moved from a swarm of locusts to possibly an invading army to the end of the story. We've moved to the end of the story. There's going to be a gathering of the nations in the valley of Jehoshaphat, and there God will put them on trial for what they did to, what does he call them? My people. God has Israel as the apple of his eye, and nations have violated them, and God will punish them for that. And then we read this in verses 13 and 14, 15 of chapter 3. come trample the grapes, for the wine press is full and the vats overflow. So great is their wickedness, these nations, multitudes, multitudes in the valley of decision, for the day of the Lord is near in the valley of decision. Okay. We're at the end. We're at the finale. We're in the final act. And God is going to judge the nations because things have ripened to such a degree that God can punish the nations for their great wickedness. And then we read this, beginning at verse 17 of chapter 3. Then you will know, then you will know that I, the Lord your God, dwell in Zion, my holy hill. Jerusalem will be holy. Never again will foreigners invade her. In that day, the mountains will drip new wine, the hills will flow with milk, and the ravines of Judah will run with water. See what happened? God is coming at the end to judge the nations, but he has singled out his own people. He has singled them out, and he's going to bless them. And those who turn their hearts to the Lord, he will bless them. Those who respond to the good news, those who respond to the gospel, he will bless them. Those who don't respond will be judged. This is heavy stuff. That God is going to bless his people, but the nations will be judged. Now, how do we take all this? Let me just wrap it up in a few words. Regardless of the fact that Jonah does not have a catalog of Israel's sins, we have read the catalogs in some of the other prophets. These are national sins. These are big sins. These are widespread sins. But what you and I are dealing with is my sin and your sin. And I think we get the picture, at least from the prophets, that God takes sin seriously. And that sin can interfere with our worship. And sin can bring on us the judgment of God to the degree that he's calling us. I think the locust plague was a kind of megaphone calling the people back to God. And the prophet Joel came to interpret it. Now, we don't believe, at least I don't believe, that every time I have trouble, every time I have sickness, that's a judgment of God, that's something about God speaking to me. But I think we need to reckon with the fact that it may be. I think we need to reckon with the fact that if we do run into trouble, that it may be God speaking to us, God trying to get our attention. And I think we need to be prepared to respond to that. We need to keep, as the people in Joel's day had not done, we need to keep our relationship with God clear. We need to keep the channels clear between us and God by confessing our sins and coming to him and bowing before him in submission. And then I close with this last point, which the Lord gave me when Ken was leading up here. The locust plague was a sign of God's love. The locust plague was a sign that God gave the people to call them back to himself. That's a sign of God's love. The locust plague was God saying, come back to me, come back to me. That's a sign of God's love. Yeah? You agree? Isn't that a sign of God's love? That he so devastated the land that the people had no choice but to turn back to him. That's a sign of his love. I hope the Lord never has to do anything like that to us. But whatever he does, whatever signals he gives us, whatever words he gives us, may we be ready to respond as we should for his glory.